Well, I'm talking today about three of the little magazines. Tropique, which was published in Martinique from 1941 to 45. VVV, or Triple V, which was founded by the exiled surrealist in New York in 1942. And Vue, a New York avant-garde magazine that was edited by Charles Henry Ford, which ran from 1940 to 1947. And I think these magazines, they're not the only ones I could talk about, but they are perhaps most important in charting surrealism's major encounters in the Americas and its attempts to find a new paradigm following the fall of France in 1940 and the Second World War. There's a dramatic contrast, actually, in the way that surrealism was received in Martinique and in New York, which highlights the complexity of its anti-nationalist position in the face of different nationalist and cultural agendas. And the way in which surrealism had been presented in the USA in the 1930s had stripped the movement of its radical politics. Influential critics like Clement Greenberg believed it was necessary to focus on saving culture rather than on politics, and he hated the anti-art stance of the historical avant-gardes and felt that surrealism had abnegated its duty to reform high culture. I think surrealism was also compromised by its exploitation in the advertising industry and by the success of Salvador Dali, who by 1940 incarnated surrealism for the American, that's the US, public. Maya Shapiro reviewed the dealer Julien Levy's book Surrealism with the words, "Surrealism seems inadequate for its task. Its imaginary mutilations appear abstract, trivial, and evasive. Moreover, there was, as we shall see, a powerful local cultural nationalism, even among apparently avant-garde artists in the USA. Surrealism's undeniable influence was systematically disavowed. As Anais Nin said, "America is rejecting all European influences, like children who reject their parental influence. Nothing must come from Europe, but they borrow and imitate as we did when we were young, only we were grateful to our influences." This is a spread from Triple V, from the final issue of Triple V, with a photograph of the Martinican poet Aimé Césaire. And I'm going to be talking about the founding of his magazine Tropique for a moment. The encounters in the Caribbean, that is with Martinique, Cuba particularly, present surrealism in a different light. Rather than thinking in terms of the influence of surrealism, whether denied or acknowledged, or of the way it has been criticised for selectively appropriating from other cultures and imposing its name, we find an encounter that opened up communications between different cultures and sensibilities. And I think these encounters changed surrealism and the surrealists, reframing their earlier Parisian ideas of the primitive in favour of cross-cultural synthesis, syncretic culture, and hybrid art forms. Now, Tropique was founded by Aimé and Suzanne Césaire and René Ménil in 1941. Césaire was born in Martinique, which was the most assimilated of the French colonies. And he won a scholarship to Paris. He studied at the École Normale Supérieure. And there he wrote his great poem, Cahier de retour au pays natal, a notebook of a return to the native country. He went back to Martinique in 1939, and in 1943, he helped organise the coup that overthrew the Vichy administration in Martinique, and the country rallied to De Gaulle. Césaire was elected the mayor of Fort-de-France, that's the capital of Martinique, in 1945, at the end of the war, and he remained its mayor, astonishingly, until 2001. He only died in 2008. He continued to believe that political assimilation was economically advantageous to Martinique, whose inhabitants agreed with him, and in fact he sat in the communist representative in the French Parliament. But cultural assimilation was a different matter altogether, and Césaire asserted throughout his poetry his essential négritude. Accommodez-vous de moi, je ne m'accommode pas de vous, he wrote in the Cahier de Retour au Pays Natal. I think in some ways, Wilfredo Lam's Jungle, and this is another spread from the same issue of Triple V, PVV, showing Lam in his Havana studio in front of the huge painting, The Jungle. And I think this painting and those related to it from the 1940s could be seen as the visual partners to Césaire's poem Cahier de retour au pays natal. And I quote a little from it. It's very difficult to translate, so I'm afraid I'm not going to try, but I'll just a couple of lines. Qui et quel nous sommes? Admirable question. It's a mixture of French and English. Haïsseur, bâtisseur, traître, Hugon, Hugon surtout. Hugon was the Santeria priesthood. Now, Lam's connections, and this is the painting, The Jungle, which belongs to the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Lam's connections with surrealism have in recent years been minimized in favor of an Afro-Cuban context for his work. Placing him within a surrealist framework has been seen as an imposition by Eurocentric art history. The Cuban art historian and critic Gerardo Mosquera has argued for a change of viewpoint, for a new account of Lam's work, looking at it less as a product, and I quote, as a product of surrealism, or in terms of the presence of primitive elements, than as a result of Cuban and Caribbean culture, and as a pioneering contribution to the role of the third world in the contemporary world. Now, although this is a salutary exercise, I think these viewpoints, surrealism and Cuba, are not necessarily incompatible. Surrealism became a scapegoat for the primitivizing fantasies of the West. Mosquera denounced, and I quote, a certain exoticism typical of the astonished Western vision, particularly among the surrealists, which extends to everything primitive, aestheticized as mystery, magic, night, darkness, fantastic, etc. The assumption that surrealism was an aestheticizing, even anesthetizing influence in the complex story of modern art outside the Western centers ignores the political commitments of this movement, whose anti-colonial stance differentiated from an earlier avant-garde which fed simply on the formal inventiveness of African art. So I think that there's certainly a change in Lam's work in about 1941, which just heralds his magnificent flowering in the painting, in the Cuban paintings, 1942-52. But it would be a mistake to equate escaping Europe with abandoning surrealism. And I would argue that, on the contrary, Lam discovered in surrealism unexpected resources precisely as a result of its displacement and the loss of its former centre, Paris. And I'm just putting up here a little group of sort of historical photographs of France, of Marseille, where the surrealists took refuge while they were waiting for a refugee ship. They were helped by Varian Fry in the refugee centre. And at the top right-hand side, there is Hitler, who had by then entered Paris. The surrealists are in the half of France that was under Vichy control, but they were still in considerable danger. I just wanted to point out in the second, this one here, there's Lam at the back and Breton and his family, and Lam appears again in some of the other photographs. And I think that his greater intimacy in Marseille over this winter, 1940-41, had a lasting effect on his work. And in Marseille, he was in daily contact with Breton, with artists like Victor Brauner, participating in collective games and projects. And I think of special significance was the revival of automatism in surrealist discourse at this time, which Lam was to interpret in a distinctive way, and of which he was one of the last great practitioners. In March 1941, Lam, together with André Breton and his family, Claude Lévi-Strauss, and other refugees, embarked from Marseille for America. The last sight of Europe was a grim reminder of its fate, and Lévi-Strauss wrote in his memoir, Triste Tropique, I did not begin to understand the situation until the day we went on board between two rows of steel-helmeted guards with machine guns at the ready, who cordoned off the quayside and cut the passengers off from any contact with the relatives and friends who had come to say goodbye. 350 passengers, mostly artists and intellectuals under threat from the Vichy regime, crammed into a small steamer with only two cabins and seven berths. Lévi-Strauss had a cabin and Breton didn't, actually, and they communicated by letter during the voyage. So it was more like a deportation of convicts, as Lévi-Strauss said. At the end of April, the overcrowded ship reached the island of Martinique, a French colony then under Vichy control, and many of the passengers, including Breton and Lamb, were promptly locked up there in what was effectively a prisoner of war camp in a former leper hospital. Breton managed to get permission to leave the camp to explore the streets of Fort-de-France, and chancing to enter a haberdasher's shop, he picked up a local publication on display there. To his astonishment, he found himself reading texts that shared the political and aesthetic views of the Surrealists. The voice in this modest journal, Tropique, and I quote Breton, said exactly what needed to be said, not just in the best way, but with the greatest force. All those mocking shadows were torn aside and dispersed. All the lies and derision fell in tatters. It was proof that, far from being broken or stifled, here the human voice rose up like the very shaft of light. Aimé Césaire was the name of the one speaking. So this was the first issue of Tropique, and its chief animators, Suzanne Césaire and René Ménil, and it was René Ménil's sister who happened to own a little haberdasher shop and quickly put Breton in contact with this group. And it's easy to understand what so moved Breton in Césaire's opening text for the first number. As well as the wholly unexpected references throughout the review to his own poetic universe, and you can see that there's a quotation from Rimbaud here, one of the Surrealists' chosen ancestors. I say one must be a seer, you must become a seer. Breton also encountered a political voice that believed in poetry, an opposition from within on a moral and social as well as aesthetic level to the Vichy regime, which was also a black voice, one who spoke from within the colonized. Even more, it was a voice of vigorous protest, unlike the feeble and masochistic publications Breton had encountered in France in the months preceding his departure. Césaire's text is a passionate protest against a colonial power subservient to fascism and what he felt was a cultural void. And I quote, "A silent and sterile land, I am speaking about ours. And my hearing measures by the Caribbean Sea the terrifying silence of man. Europe, Africa, Asia, I hear screaming steel, drumbeats in the bush, temples praying midst banyan trees, and I know it is man speaking, but here is the monstrous atrophy of the voice, the age-old exhaustion, the incredible mutism, no city, no art, no poetry. But," he goes on, "we are the kind who refuse the shadow." And Tropique was censored by the Vichy regime, who controlled Martinique, and it disguised its political critiques in various ways, publishing incendiary poetry, scientific studies of local flora and fauna, Leo Frobenius on African civilizations, Negro-Cuban folk tales gathered by Lydia Cabrera, poems and texts by Césaire, Breton, Mabi, and Perret. And there's no sudden adoption of surrealism, because it was unnecessary for the journal to change its direction in any sense. And with Tropique, the Surrealists encountered a movement of a new kind whose championing of the black population and cultures and challenge to colonial classical French values endorsed and justified their own intransigence. Césaire was himself also clear about the reciprocal value for him of their support. "Breton brought us boldness. He cut short our uncertainties. I would say that the meeting with Breton was a confirmation of the truth of what I had discovered by my own reflections." And he also, Césaire, gives a very moving description of Breton, not just as a poet, but as one who sought out poetry. I quote Césaire, "He literally fascinated me. He had an astonishing sense of poetry. He sensed poetry. He sniffed it like pollen in the air. A poet and a philosopher. The meeting with Breton was a very important thing for me." And as Suzanne Césaire wrote in her text in the eighth issue of Tropique in 1943, "Surrealism and Us," "Surrealism was an activity whose dynamism could assist human emancipation, an activity which could, and I quote, liberate man by revealing his unconscious, assisting the liberation of peoples by clarifying the blind myths that have governed them hitherto. I continue the quote. The arrow of history indicates our human task. A society tainted in its origins by crime, supported at the present time by injustice and hypocrisy, rendered fearful of its future by bad conscience, must, morally, historically, necessarily disappear. And among the powerful war machines that the modern world has placed at our disposal, our audacity has chosen surrealism, which offers the best chance of success. Lamb is first mentioned in the second issue of Tropique, as the astonishing black Cuban painter in whom we meet at the same time as the best of Picasso's tutelage, Asiatic and African traditions, curiously and intelligently mingled. And in the sixth issue of Tropique, there was a commentary on Lamb by Pierre Loeb, and I quote, he mentions an astonishing range of works with which Lamb surrounded himself in Paris, Ivory Coast masks, New Hebrides tree fern carvings, Easter Island fetishes, sculptures from Papua New Guinea. And you can see here is a photograph of Lamb's studio actually after the war, but showing some of these extraordinary sculptures that he collected. So it wasn't just the Cuban context, it was a much broader one than that. And Loeb tells the following anecdote against himself. He, while they were in Paris, remarked to Picasso, "He's influenced by Negro art." And Picasso, furious, replied, "Well, he has the right, him, he is black." On May 16th, 1941, Lamb, Breton, Lamba, and Aube left Martinique. From Santo Domingo, they stopped in Santo Domingo, and from there, Breton and his family sailed to New York, while Lamb and Holzer left for Cuba, arriving in late July 1941. Lamb had brought practically nothing with him. He had to start again from scratch. And his first impression on his return to Havana was one of terrible sadness. The whole colonial drama of my youth seemed to be reborn in me. Cuba was the difference from Martinique was that Cuba was an independent country, not a colony, but it had become a playground for the rich. This is pre-Castro. And most Cubans of African descent lived in poverty. Lamb was appalled by the conditions and the cultural as well as economic forms of exploitation. Havana, he said at that time, was a land of pleasure, sugary music, rumbas, mambos, and so forth. Poetry in Cuba then was either political and committed, like that of Nicolas Guillen and a few others, or else written for the tourists. The latter I rejected, for it had nothing to do with an exploited people, with a society that had crushed and humiliated its slaves. No, I decided that my painting would never be the equivalent of that pseudo-Cuban music for nightclubs. I refused to paint cha-cha-cha. I wanted with all my heart to paint the drama of my country, but by thoroughly expressing the Negro spirit, the beauty of the plastic art of the blacks. In this way, I could act as a Trojan horse that would spew forth hallucinating figures with the power to surprise, to disturb the dreams of the exploiters. And I just say a little bit about Lamb and Césaire's Négritude. Tropique was the precursor of Négritude. But in fact, its chief animators of Tropique took very different views of Négritude. And while Césaire was one of its foremost exponents, Menil was one of its most trenchant critics. For Menil, it became a dangerously reductive political ideology based on an essentialist notion of identity which merely inverted black-white values. Lamb's position, while still sympathetic to the poetic uses to which Césaire put Négritude, basically agreed with Menil. Responding to the accusation of black racism, Lamb replied, "It's a false accusation. They say that because I don't paint like a European, because I try to paint with the idiosyncrasy of my people. The personages in my paintings are neither white nor black. They lack race. I am not in agreement with the doctrine of Negritude either. It's not a matter of race, but of the class struggle." So, this is the jungle. Lamb painted it in 20 days in December 1942. And what you see standing out against a vibrant, pulsating canvas of yellows, blues, and greens is a blanched, moonlit arm with long fingers. which gestures towards a group of strange and sometimes menacing figures, half hidden among the sugar canes and the papaya and the breadfruit trees. The raised arm belongs to a character on the left of the painting, who is, Lamb remarked, as if it will experience a revelation at the sight of the other personages in the painting, astonished by the discovery of this whole universe. The jungle, frankly, quotes Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon, but its reference to Picasso is of a different kind from the broadly formal resemblance between Lamb's paintings of the late 1930s, such as this one here, this very simplified, flattened figure with strong black outlines and mask-like features. And I think the relationship with the Demoiselle d'Avignon, which you see on the right here, Picasso's painting from 1907, is actually rather different. The jungle deliberately sets up a dialogue with the Demoiselle. The five figures in the jungle, which are in a sense made up of fragments of different bits of bodies with mask-like faces, and one of them on the right-hand side who seems to sport a large breast, rather like a fruit, and is clutching a pair of scissors. And the others you can just about make out. They can sort of merge in the background. And they're arranged in shallow relief across the picture surface. The gesture of the one on the left in the demoiselle, that's this one here, whose dark head derived from a primitivist Gauguin, acknowledges the scene, as in the jungle, and presents it to the spectators. Picasso turns the other four women, inhabitants of the brothel in Avignon Street, that's where the title of the painting comes from, he transforms them into terrifying gorgons, and it's one of his most misogynist images. It's as if they're staring the spectator into stone. Lamb transposes the ambiguity of the demoiselle with its rough overlay of masks on the decadent pink bodies of the prostitutes into a tropical setting. The figures are also life-size and confront us with a mixture of lewd sexuality and impenetrable ritual masks. Lamb explained that he is actually condemning what happens in the jungle. Look at my monsters, the gestures they make. The one on the right offers her haunch, obscene, like a great prostitute. Look also at the scissors being brandished. My idea was to represent the spirit of the blacks in the situation in which they found themselves. I showed through poetry the reality of acceptance and of protest. Contrasting his jungle with those of Henri Rousseau, I put up the dream here, and as they had begun to discover by this time, Rousseau, of course, never travelled to the jungle. He painted what was in the Jardin des Plantes in Paris. But this is one of his most famous jungle paintings. But Lamb said, contrasting his jungles with those of Rousseau, he was a formidable painter, but he doesn't belong to my natural chain. He doesn't condemn what happens in the jungle. I do. Lamb was equally remote from the celebration of picturesque Cuba, the kind of cha-cha-cha he was talking about, and a comparison with a celebrated painting by Mario Carreño, Afro-Cuban Dance, 1943, highlights the differences. Carreño depicts two figures, a bare-breasted nightclub dancer and a diablito on the left, the latter a popular subject in 19th century costumbrista paintings. It's a stereotype of the exotic tropical scene to entertain the viewer with a frisson of lust and danger. Lamb, by contrast, confronts the viewer, just as Picasso does, with an ambiguous challenge to their expectations. And this is a study for the jungle, a similar but not identical figure from the right-hand side of the large canvas. So I think the transformation of Lamb's imagery and style on his return to Cuba involved not so much a rejection of his Paris period as a breakthrough in which surrealist ideas found a wholly original expression. There is a change in the way in which the paint is applied, and the hybrid creatures emerge out of or meld into their settings. This is an altar to Elegua, one of the orisha or spirits in the Santeria religion in Cuba. It's an altar with various objects on it. But I think in later paintings like these, this is 1943, colour is applied in loose streaks, dabs and washes, or in luminous shifting clouds of bright pigment dusted over the surface. This is not to imply an abstraction or separation of colour from the subject of the paintings, but rather to point out a freeing of the hand, a spontaneity of gesture that seems to be integral to his representation of the world of Orishas and other personages of the imagination. Lamb credited automatism with releasing memories from his Cuban childhood, and I quote, "In an automatic manner, as the Surrealists say, this world leaked out from me. That is to say, I carried all this in my subconscious, and letting myself get carried away by automatic painting, this strange world sprang out." And I think that the renewed interest in automatism among the Surrealists in the early 1940s partly emerged in their experience in Martinique, in the jungle, and for Lamb in Cuba. In Martinique, Breton and his family were joined by Masson, and they were all bowled over by the tropical beauties of Martinique. They published a very lyrical Creole dialogue in a small collaborative book called Martinique, Charmeuse de Serpent. Martinique, Serpent Charmer, and I quote from the book, "The liana flower is too slender, too white to be a star. It could only slip from a sylph's letter. When you manage to make out their forms in their entirety, these lianas, I'm talking about those that are so upright, so tall, are truly the heart of the earth." And Masson's own paintings and drawings, such as this one here of the vegetation in Martinique, were a fervent rediscovery of free and spontaneous gestures. And when Breton arrived in New York, he immediately published his Artistic Genesis and Perspective of Surrealism, which reaffirmed the notion of automatism, but with a new tolerance for an automatism that was not strictly pure, as it had rarely been anyway for the artists. And I quote, "Automatism inherited from the mediums has remained one of Surrealism's two great directions. Since it is automatism that has aroused and still arouses the most violent controversy, it cannot be too late to seek to analyse its function rather more deeply, and so try to sway the argument decisively in its favour. Contemporary psychological research has suggested that a comparison can be drawn between the construction of a nest by a bird and the beginning of a melody that is in the process of establishing a definite theme. Without prejudice to the deep individual tensions that graphic and verbal automatism brings to the surface, I maintain that it is the only mode of expression which gives full satisfaction to both eye and ear by achieving rhythmic unity, just as recognisable in an automatic drawing or text as in a melody or a bird's nest. The only structure that corresponds to the by now widely acknowledged non-differentiation between sympathetic and formal qualities. I will concede that it is possible for automatism to enter into the composition of a painting or a poem with a certain degree of premeditation. But the converse holds true, that any form of expression which automatism does not, at least, advance under cover runs a grave risk of moving out of the Surrealist orbit." And Lamont commented on his own paintings and drawings, saying they contain the rhythm of automatic work. I just wanted to say a little bit about Lamb's the painting of the Cuban Santeria religion, and to sort of draw a difference between his paintings and that of the artist Hippolyte in Haiti. This is a painting by Hippolyte on the right hand side here, which shows Shango Ogon Ferai, who is the god of war and iron. Now, when Breton visited Haiti and spoke to Hippolyte, he asked him what he thought of Lamb's paintings, which Breton was then hanging for an exhibition in Haiti at the Port-au-Prince Art Centre. And Hippolyte affirmed a vigorous and deferential interest in them, while still retaining a slight air of reserve, because in his view it was Chinese magic rather than the African magic, which was, he implied, his own province of knowledge. I think that the point really is that hitherto there was almost no two-dimensional representation of the various spirits and ideas and beliefs in Santeria or in Haitian voodoo. On the left I put up a typical sort of set of offerings, which is very often very syncretic. This one, as you can see, includes a crucifixion, as well as the kind of sign language that was typical of this the Santeria. This is from the museum at Guanabacoa near Havana. But there was no tradition of painting, not like the Christian religion, which of course, you know, has this magnificent tradition of two-dimensional imagery. And Hippolyte was the first artist, really, and he was also a priest, to try and represent the Orishas, that is, the spirits of this world in two dimensions. But he is, I think, more interested actually in a sense, making a record of them. I mean, this is almost like a sort of icon, whereas Lam is drawing from a whole series of different sources. And his paintings constitute a very complex imaginary, which has the power to convey contradictory meanings and to encompass satire and humour, as well as politics and the supernatural. So he was familiar with the ceremonies and objects associated with Cuba's most widespread religious practices in Santeria, but he wasn't a practitioner, unlike Hippolyte. This one is a painting called Malembo, God of the Crossroads. And this is personages, which I think... Sorry, I must... where you can see the... the heads, the sort of twin heads of the Orisha known as Elegua, which are linked and reversible. And they recall both the sacred twins of Haitian voodoo and, I think, the reversible half-length figures of the court pictures in playing cards. And two of these, the Alice and L'Otriamont, are part of the game of playing cards that the Surrealists invented in Marseille, and all of them produced new versions of the King, Queen and Jack using Surrealist heroes and heroines. So like the Surrealists, Lam took a relaxed attitude to the contradictions in their position of trying to combine dialectical materialism with the defence of superstition and magic. And it's the poetic as well as the political that Lam is interested in, and he didn't usually employ specific symbology. He said, "I never created my pictures in terms of a symbolic tradition, but always on the basis of a poetic excitation. I believe in poetry. For me, it is the great conquest of mankind. Revolution, for instance, is a poetic creation. I say everything through the pictorial image." Now, I'm going to move now to the other two magazines, Triple V and View. And I want to talk a little bit about Breton's Prolegomena to a Third Manifesto of Surrealism, or else, I think it should be or not, probably. The magazine was crucial for the survival and identity of the Surrealist group in exile. The Prolegomena to a Third Surrealist Manifesto or Not was the most important publication, the most important essay in the first issue of Triple V. Breton was faced with the bankruptcy of previous modes of knowledge and intervention, including communism. And he speculates on what is left, and he asks, can a society exist without a social myth? But he's unable to give an answer. He does, however, suggest that, to begin with, it would not be a bad idea to convince man that he is not necessarily the king of creation, as he boasts. Whatever the new social myth might be, it must challenge conventional modes of thinking. He ends with a section that he calls Les Grands Transparents, the Great Invisibles, which had illustrations by Roberto Matta, which you can just about make out here. And here he suggests, in apparently science fiction mode, that there is no reason not to think that there exist above man beings whose behaviour is as alien to his as his own must be to the mayfly or whale. And I think there is more of Dada in this than one might think, though it's couched in these rather mysterious terms. But most influential in the contents of Triple V was the shift away from the human psyche towards nature, including the tropical. But this is a small interlude picking up on the question of automatism and the problem of the, as it were, the disavowal of Surrealism's influence in New York. I've put up here a painting by Masson, done while he was living in Connecticut in the United States in the mid-1940s, called Pacify. And also one of his sand paintings, one of the earlier automatist sand paintings. And I would suggest that there is obviously a link and a relationship with Pollock's painting. This is Jackson Pollock's Fall Fathom 5, which is a painting, very difficult to see this in reproduction, but it's a painting that is encrusted with other materials, with bits of sand and other stuff that Pollock has stuck on. And obviously the free gestural movement of the paint is related to Masson's work. But and I put up here Pollock's painting called Pacify, the same subject as Masson's, above Masson's Pacify, just really to emphasize the fact, which is one that William Rubin was always very, very keen also to acknowledge and to celebrate, that artists like Pollock did owe a great deal to Surrealism, but really it was it was very hidden under the desire to create a new American painting, and that was the sort of rhetoric that was associated with it. And in fact, neither Triple V nor Vue actually reproduce any of the automatist works by the abstract expressionists, which is also quite interesting. Leonora Carrington published her extraordinary text down below about her madness in Triple V. But I want to just spend a little time looking at another artist for whom the tropics and the jungle were a very important inspiration, though in a much more accepting way than Lamb's ambivalent and slightly satirical view of the jungle. This is an artist called Maria Martins, usually known as Maria. This page from the final issue of Triple V shows a work of hers called Macumba, reproduced above a poem by Césaire called Batuque. And Batuque is apparently the word for the rhythm of the tam-tam in Brazil. Breton wrote a preface to Maria's 1947 exhibition in New York. He had first seen her work in 1943 in New York. But he wrote in his preface a celebration of the South by contrast with the North. And I quote, "During the last few years, the breath of the human spirit has not ceased to blow from warm lands. Another wind, which seems nowadays to consist of solid blocks of ice, whistles vainly down the chimneys of Europe to discover nothing but naked grates or bars on which thin, tangled vine stalks are smouldering without giving off heat." For Breton, Maria's sculpture is indissolubly linked to her own and her country's allure. Maria's sculpture began by carrying on its shoulders a whole legend, I quote, "which, décolleté like the water itself by the vines of her land, was no less than the Amazon, which sang through the works that I so admired in 1943 in New York, which sang with all its immemorial voices of man's passion from birth to death, that the Indian tribes, which have succeeded each other along its treacherous banks, have known better than anyone how to condense in the most encompassing symbols." This elegant interweaving, this passage from Breton's preface, of the natural world, the sculpture, and the legends that inspired Maria's work, concentrates in the term décolleté, which hints at the female body disclosed, as well as being a striking metaphor for vegetation emerging from the waters of the Amazon. And it's clear that nature and the tropics are, for him, sort of seen through this seductive sculpture and seductive sculptress. to accompany her exhibition at the Valentine Gallery in New York in 1943, she published Amazonia, a series of texts based on the legends of the gods or spirits of the Amazon. The introduction by Jorge Zarur situates her text in relation to the Indian people of Amazonia, who have a fascinating folklore and tradition. Now, some of the gods that she includes, such as Yemenja here, would now be thought of as Afro-Brazilian, but Maria's approach is to locate her stories in the Indian Amazon and treat incomers, such as Yemenja or Ayoka, as having chosen Brazil as their new home. Ayoka, who is another of her characters, came to Brazil from a distant land, I'm quoting Maria, and was so entranced by the country that she made Amazonia her domain. In the sculpture Cobra Grande, here, the undulating body of the serpent, sprouting breasts, rises to touch the vegetation that arches up on each side. Both here and with Macumba, Maria has created an entire scene of figures and animals in their tropical setting, rather than showing a single isolated figure. Breton described Macumba as a hymn to the god of spasm, in which the flesh, yielding like the bud of a flower, becomes impregnated with all the strange dendritic markings of the native metal. And I think with this reference to dendritic or tree-like structures of native metalworking, Breton points to the iron sculptures of Haitian voodoo artists, such as this work by Murat Briere called Tree Snake Lower, in which the lower is like a Brazilian orisha or spirit or god with particular powers related to their arena of activity. And I think this one with its snake-like tentacles which branches from the central stalk is not entirely unlike Maria's work. I'm just going to show very quickly some of her work that was shown in the 1947 exhibition in Paris, which was Surrealism's attempt to return to its former position of eminence in the artistic and cultural world in Paris, and didn't wholly succeed, but it was a very extraordinary exhibition. And it's interesting that her The World, the Shadow, Too Long, Too Narrow was reproduced above David Hare's Suicide. The catalogue for this exhibition was designed by Marcel Duchamp, and it had a hand-painted falsi on the front of the deluxe edition with the title Please Touch. And I should say that this is from the Eros exhibition of 1959 to 1960, where Maria was included as one of today's surrealists, together with Arp, together with Duchamp. There is Maria with a sculpture called Impossible, which I think is really her masterpiece. It exists in plaster and in bronze. And it shows two figures. One is a bust and the other is half-length, confronting each other with their heads strikingly transformed. Like two galvanized sea anemones, fronds shoot from the circumference of the two empty, faceless heads, both of them desperately reaching out and shivering with aggressive force, simultaneously attracting and repulsing. A biographical connection is often made with Maria's personal life at this time, when she was involved in an intense love affair with Marcel Duchamp, and she was the inspiration behind his last major work, The Room That Was Kept Secret Until His Death in 1968, The Étendonné. But I think Impossible could as well have been inspired by the wider context of a world war nearing its end in 1944, when she began the first version. She said in 1946, just after the end of the war, "The world is complicated and sad. It is nearly impossible to make people understand one another." Impossible is one of the most powerful images in the 20th century of the dystopian human condition of desire and conflict, of the clash of opposing forces and a basic failure to communicate. So I go back to Triple V, and I want to end by looking at Triple V and briefly at View magazine, which has been rather squeezed out tonight, I'm sorry about that, in relation to their their presentation of Duchamp's work and of Cornell. Now, in VVV, very little contemporary American art was represented. In fact, almost nothing. The emphasis is almost exclusively on indigenous America, the tropics, and Europe. The first issue did attempt to link to American writers. Harold Rosenberg contributed an aggressive text called Life and Death of an Amorous Umbrella, attacking some core beliefs of surrealism. And the experiment was then not repeated, and the magazine really tended to close ranks. And I've just shown one of the works by Duchamp here. He also did the cover for this issue, which is the head of Washington. This was actually commissioned for a cover of Vogue magazine, and it was rejected because the red paint on the gauze was too reminiscent of wounds and bandages. And so it was reproduced in Triple V instead. And if you turn it round, you can see that it's also the United States itself. It's called Allegory of Genre. Now, View, by contrast, as its name promised, took a broad view of the avant-garde. It was a very important conduit for surrealist art and poetry, while not losing touch with modern American culture. It was small, precious, and chatty. Parker Tyler recalled the rivalry that was felt when VVV started up. Its editor, the artist David Hare, was Breton's third choice. He'd previously asked Robert Motherwell and then Charles Henry Ford, who had both refused. And I quote Parker Tyler's memoirs, "Soon there appears a 100% surrealist rival magazine, short-lived though it be, Triple V, or VVV as it is called. We conclude that obviously it is meant to be three times as good as View." So there was a kind of rivalry between Triple V and View. And View, as I say, included a lot of surrealists. It dedicated specific issues to individual artists from the surrealist movement. But it also insisted on showing modern American artists. As you can see here, I put up an advertisement there on the left, View for October, an American number. And it also included, like VVV, Tropical Americana, and this is the Series 5, number 2, May 1945, issue on Tropical Americana, presented by Paul Bowles. One of the most striking of the issues of View is this one from 1945, with a cover by Duchamp, and I think Duchamp, who was to have such an enormous impact on post-war American art, as well as on post-war European art, is actually, I think, one of the very important sources for his influence was this issue of View. The cover is on the left. On the right is the back cover, which is one of the first public appearances of Duchamp's notion of the infra-thin, that infra-masse, which is remember, this is somebody who has sort of given up painting. He's given up producing work for exhibitions. He's almost given up practicing as an artist at all, though clearly from this kind of activity he's still doing something. But it's become very minimal and even liminal. And this, the inference here, the little statement says, "When the smoke of tobacco also smells of the mouth that exhales it, the two smells marry by infra-thin." Right, so that may be rather opaque, but I shall come back to talk about the infra-thin a little bit more next week. Inside this issue of the magazine, there is an extraordinary fold-out sort of photo collage of Duchamp's work. And because it's so difficult to understand, I've actually brought a copy with me. If anybody wants to see how it works, do come up afterwards and have a look. But it shows on the left-hand side, the left page here, with two flaps folded in, and on the right-hand side, the flaps are folded out, and you can see Duchamp himself sitting in this extraordinary collage of all his works, including Tuma and The Large Glass, set within a scene from the city of New York. This is by the architect and artist Kiesler, and on the back cover you see the Né Artiste Inventeur, that's 1887, that's Duchamp's date of birth, and beneath that, Né Artiste Inventeur, 1877, that was Kiesler. And the photograph here shows the installation of the 1942 First Papers of Surrealism exhibition at in New York. That was the Exile Surrealists' first show there. And the installation was by Duchamp. And as you can see, it was an installation that was basically a frustrating one, because Duchamp, he entangled the works in the show in what he called a mile of string, which meant it was very difficult actually to get in to see what was there, and it's like an enormous web. And I'm also going to be talking more about string as a medium next week. And the final artist I want to look at from view is someone who was really a total contrast with those I've been talking about so far, and that is Joseph Cornell. And I wanted to show him because I think it's quite interesting how, whereas the Surrealists in Triple V, on the whole, well, the VVV did not take to vernacular American art. Cornell is one of the great masters at combining surrealism with the vernacular. This is two pages from his text called The Crystal Cage from View, an extraordinary imaginative text. This is one of his a page from the from View 1941-2 about Hedy Lamarr. He was obsessed and infatuated by the film stars and by ballet dancers. And some of his best work, I think, is actually a way of celebrating this. This is a homage to Lauren Bacall. So Hollywood, I mean, he manages to make this sort of bridge between Hollywood and surrealism. He uses boxes, he uses always ready-made materials, he uses photographs put together in this very alluring and lyrical way. And this is one of the untitled boxes, which includes all sorts of little found objects, little bits and pieces, little bits of Americana, little things picked up on the beach, put in this in a grid, in a formal grid. And I think Cornell is very interesting how Cornell also he sort of touches on abstract art as well as on surrealism. And I'm going to end with one of his sand fountain boxes. One of the sad things about works of art in museums is that you can't handle them. And with Cornell, this is particularly problematic because many of the boxes, not all, but many of the boxes are actually made to be picked up, tilted, shaken, and so on. This is a sand fountain that actually belonged to Duchamp. It was given to him. And the sand is tilted into a sort of cavity at the back, and then when it's turned the right way up, it pours out onto a broken glass. And so it's kind of a work in action, as well as being a sort of formerly very 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 fine piece of a sort of structure, a construction. And I want to pick up next week and talk more about the ephemeral, about as it were works that should be handled, and how these relate to a post-war sort of rediscovery of Dada and of surrealism. Thank you.